Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with today's resignation by the Nobel Peace Prize winning former Secretary General of the UN, Kofi Annan, who quit as the UN Arab League Special Envoy to Syria. David Sheffer, who led the US delegation in UN talks establishing the International Criminal Court, joins us to examine the human rights situation in Syria that continues to deteriorate while the UN Security Council remains paralyzed. Then we will speak with Habib Battar, a Beirut-based journalist, media critic, and author of the blog BeirutReport.com, about the spillover into Lebanon from the war next door in Syria and what a defeat of the Assad regime will mean for Hezbollah's influence in Lebanon. We will also discuss Habib Battar's article at Al Monitor, The Good and Bad Muslims of Western Media. Then finally, we'll be joined in the studio by Alison Clayman, the filmmaker of the award-winning feature documentary Ai Weiwei, Never Sorry, that opens nationwide on Friday. She lived in China from 2006 to 2010 and followed the artist and activist Ai Weiwei for 2 years, gaining unprecedented access to his life and work, resulting in an inspiring film about a great artist who almost single-handedly has taken on the ruthless regime of repression that keeps China's corrupt and cruel Communist Party in power. Joining us now is David Sheffer, who's a lawyer and diplomat who served as the first United States ambassador at large for war crimes issues during President Clinton's second term. He led the U.S. delegation in UN talks establishing the International Criminal Court and currently teaches international criminal law and international human rights law at the Northwestern University School of Law, where he directs the Center for International Human Rights. Sheffer's award-winning new book, All the Missing Souls, A Personal History of the War Crimes Tribunals, recounts the building of the tribunals in the 1990s from an insider's perspective. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Sheffer.
Thank you. It's good to be with you, Ian.
And today, Kofi Annan, Nobel Peace Prize winning former Secretary General of the United Nations, quit as the UN Arab League Special Envoy to Syria. He did so with some frustration and bitterness, obviously. You probably worked with him. What was your response to this? Somewhat not surprising, I guess, because he wasn't exactly making much progress.
Well, that's correct. And I don't think we should be too surprised. After all, his current term of office in that position expires at the end of August. So there's sort of a natural transition point here for him to consider whether he takes on another, you know, 3, 4, 5 month assignment, or whether he simply terminates at this point. Clearly, the very tough negotiations that he engaged in and the plan that he developed as a consequence of those negotiations has not been very successful. And when that point is reached after so many efforts, frankly, it's sometimes a very natural development, whether it be in the UN context or in bilateral negotiations between nations when you have a mediator, for there to be a transition to a new individual to try to create a new atmosphere and a new effort. So I don't think it's surprising, really, that Mr. Annan would decide at this point that he's exhausted his efforts and his ability to influence the situation.
Well, he had a six-point plan, and frankly, I don't think any of the 6 points were met. In his resignation, he did, pretty much castigate the UN Security Council for its persistent divisions in the UN. Security Councils have themselves become an obstacle to diplomacy, making the work of any mediator vastly more difficult. That's actually, I'm quoting Ban Ki-moon. But clearly, he, with a divided Security Council, what can be done? I mean, what could he have done?
Well, this is what's so very difficult about the system under which we operate. There has been at the end of the Cold War and over the last 20 years, there has been far more opportunity within the Security Council to take action with respect to human rights and crises and atrocities and acts of aggression because the Soviet Union then transformed into Russia and there was a somewhat more forthcoming position by Russia to some of these initiatives, certainly in the first decade after the end of the Cold War. That opportunity has now been closing. It has been tightening, and Russia is returning to some of its old patterns of resistance to these types of efforts to initiate a very assertive Security Council role in these types of situations. If that's the case, and it continues to be the case with Russia and then with China following behind us, we sort of have a new sort of post-Cold War phenomenon here that I don't know what to call it yet, but it's kind of a standoff phenomenon where these two particular countries are, in fact, very prepared to block assertive and dynamic action by the Security Council, whether it be the imposition of more sanctions or ultimately the use of military force for humanitarian purposes. That those opportunities are now becoming far less possible with this standoff situation. So I think what it means, particularly with the developments today and Kofi Annan's decision to retire from this effort, I suspect more attention will now be directed outside of the Security Council as to what options various governments have with respect to the situation in Syria. We'll either migrate, as it actually is migrating, to the General Assembly. The problem there is that that's a non-binding process. But nonetheless, it can be a very influential expression of international opinion. And then it probably will migrate more towards what individual countries within the NATO alliance and within the Arab League decide can be done with respect to the conflict there. And that opens up a whole range of new options.
Again, I'm speaking with David Sheffer, who was ambassador-at-large for war crimes issues during President Clinton's second term. He led the U.S. delegation in the U.N. talks establishing the International Criminal Court and currently teaches international criminal law and international human rights law at the Northwestern University School of Law, where he directs the Center for International Human Rights. His latest book is All the Missing Souls, A Personal History of the War Crimes Tribunals. So the one thing you didn't mention there is the General Assembly and the possibility of it going to NATO. And that, of course, is going to be fairly, the Russians and the Chinese are pretty bitter, particularly about what happened in the case of the Russians in Libya. They felt they got had on that one. Although Putin, of course, in many ways shares the same delusions as Assad. Putin believes that Hillary Clinton's behind the demonstrations against him in the streets of Moscow, and
right.
And Assad believes that this whole thing is a foreign plot against him. So to that extent, they're on the same page, Putin and Assad. But what about this thing moving to the international criminal courts?
Well, before I get to that, let me just comment that I think as the months go on here, this criticism that Russia has with respect to what the Security Council did in Libya that ultimately resulted not only in a humanitarian rescue of the civilian population of Libya, but also a regime transformation in Libya. The Gaddafi regime collapsed, obviously. That was their big problem with that effort, that they didn't think that the Libyan operation should have resulted in actual regime change, and they don't want to see that repeated in Syria. That was a premise for their criticism many months ago, but as these months progress and the death count rises in Syria, and a civil war has clearly now resulted in Syria, I think that argument becomes a pretext for other deeper concerns that Russia has about losing an ally in terms of the Assad regime in Syria and its stakehold in the Middle East. I just think that becomes a far less convincing argument as the months progress, the death count rises, the credibility of that argument greatly diminishes. Now, when it comes to the International Criminal Court, it's important for the audience to know that the court has no jurisdiction over Syria at this time. Syria is not a state party to the court. and therefore the court does not have some natural reach of jurisdiction over Syria. The only way that that jurisdiction can be obtained is if the Security Council refers the situation in Syria to the International Criminal Court, which requires a resolution under Chapter 7 of the UN Charter and no veto among the permanent members. Russia and China, given their position on Syria, vetoing sanctions resolutions and many other very tough resolutions on Syria that have been advanced by France, Britain, the United States, and others, one might expect that they would also veto a resolution referring Syria to the International Criminal Court for investigation of Bashar al-Assad and his colleagues in the government. So that's why you don't see the criminal court seized with Syria yet. One wonders whether it's worth the effort to try to get a referral out of the Security Council by considering some kind of understanding with Russia and China that an arrangement could be offered to Bashar al-Assad that there is going to be a referral to the court, but you have 1 week to leave the country, step down from power, and if you do so, you will not be subject to the jurisdiction of the court because the Security Council more or less controls the character of that jurisdiction and its referral resolution. That would be a nice deal for Bashar al-Assad. I mean, he could find asylum in Russia, be outside of the jurisdiction of that court, and simply decide that that's how he's going to have to live the rest of his life. My guess is that he would never accept that deal, and Russia and China might not accept that kind of a deal. But what do we have to lose by trying it? So that's sort of the current situation with the ICC. I might also add, though, that international justice, you always have to take a long-term view of it. Years from now, there may indeed be a new government in Syria. And when that new government comes to power, it will be able to exercise jurisdiction over Bashar al-Assad for all of these atrocities that have occurred over the last 17 months. So justice is not being denied here. It can ultimately have its day, but we may have to wait a considerably long time before Bashar al-Assad and his colleagues face the bar of justice.
Well, in his resignation speech today, Kofi Annan did say that President Bashar al-Assad will have to leave sooner or later. And you would think that, and given that Putin is has met today in London with British Prime Minister David Cameron to discuss Syria, you would think that his paranoia aside about West interference, he would have some realpolitik tugging at him, making him realize that Russia is not going to be real popular in that country.
Precisely. Russia is not gaining any friends internationally, and it's certainly not gaining any support among a large swath of the Syrian populace with its current position. So if it were to have a long-range view, it could actually come in and be essentially the savior of the entire situation if it wanted to take that lead and provide Bashar al-Assad and his top colleagues with asylum in Russia, and then work towards a transformation of Syria and an end to the violence that takes place there. It actually has that power to do that, but it's not exercising it. So, we'll see what ultimately develops with respect to the outcome of this entire crisis with respect to Russia's posture in the world.
Well, David Sheffer, we already have hints that this thing is going to get incredibly bloody, and it may get to the point of the use of chemical weapons. We've already seen the execution of prisoners. Now, quite likely they were the Shabiha, the murderous militia, but that hardly justifies them being placed up against the wall and machine gun while people yell Allah Akbar.
That's right.
So it's going to get uglier and uglier. You know, the jihadis are coming in sort of parasitically to get influence. The whole thing's turning into a nightmare and a human rights atrocity writ large.
And I might add, it's true that justice will have to look at all perpetrators when it can finally be rendered in Syria. You know, if you go onto YouTube now, you can find one film after another, including yesterday's summary executions, available to see, and they're very, very gruesome. So a lot of very gruesome and horrible killings and massacres are taking place in Syria at this time, and it would appear as if both sides are engaged in this, although one knows that the heavy artillery and the sort of clearance of city blocks is really something that one at least presumes is coming from the government side of the conflict. I might just add that as this conflict continues to spill over the borders of Syria into Turkey and into Lebanon and into Iraq and elsewhere, because, you know, there are tens of thousands of refugees now flowing out of Syria, it does give rise to one of these other options that actually can be activated outside of the Security Council, at least temporarily, and that is the principle of collective self-defense, that there might become some point where Turkey and Lebanon and others can actually invoke the international principle of collective self-defense and respond with some military response, at least along the border, to Syria, and invoke that principle, simply report to the Security Council that they're invoking it, and they'll be in compliance with the UN Charter by doing so. So as this becomes a far more serious conflict, as the civil war spills over borders, it should not be underestimated that the long-held principle of self-defense under international law will begin to activate. It will become very operational.
Well, that's interesting. I've not heard that, and I wonder whether, has anybody been discussing this? Because obviously I could understand Turkey invoking it, and Jordan, who are receiving a lot of refugees, Iraq, because of the Iranian influence over that government that we put into power.
Right.
Let's not go into the follies of George W. Bush, but the long and the short of it is that Iraq would not probably join in that, and neither would Lebanon.
No, but that's, you know, even Turkey, if it's become subject to a real threat from Bashar al-Assad and the Syrian military, can invoke the principle of collective self-defense by calling upon its NATO allies to help it defend itself. And that would be true even under the NATO treaty, under Article 5 of the NATO treaty. They would say, we're under attack. The United States, Canada, UK, France, Germany, please come to our assistance under this attack. And they would be invoking collective self-defense as embodied in the NATO treaty to make that claim. So, you know, I'm just saying that's out there as a possibility. And at some point, the spillover of refugees and fighting that gets close to the border and a civil war that simply gets out of control can pretty easily lead to discussions within governments such as that in Turkey to this kind of rationale to say, look, we have to respond. And it can open, you know, other opportunities, obviously, to deal with the situation.
Well, already, of course, the Syrian army has had taken pot shots at the Jordanians, so I can see that this is a real possibility. I thank you so much for joining us here today, David Sheffer.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Again, I've been speaking with David Sheffer, who's a lawyer and diplomat who served as the first United States ambassador at large for war crimes issues during President Clinton's second term. He led the U.S. delegation in U.N. talks establishing the International Criminal Court and currently teaches international criminal law and international human rights law at the Northwestern University School of Law, where he directs the Center for International Human Rights. Sheffer's award-winning new book, All the Missing Souls, A Personal History of the War Crimes Tribunals, recounts the buildings of the tribunals in the 1990s from an insider's perspective. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the good and bad Muslims of Western media.
Time and time and time we see these acts against humanity, while each for reaching each world leader, shed blood for what they each believe. On and on and on we go, well, some will you see and some won't be. Truth for you and truth will lead you to a sensor.